Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about part 5, chapter 32, and then we're reading chapter 33, which is a long chapter, and it's also the last chapter of part 5, so that's excitement for everyone. Off to the opera. Very fun. Tolstoy loves a good opera scene, an opera chapter. Anna gave Vronsky an earful discuss. I'm Norwegian, said I. Just listened to yesterday's podcast where you explained that the guy's breath just smelled like breath, and I'd like to change my answer to the does that make me gay question. So, apparently, yes, then that does make me gay. Hell of a way to find out that you're gay. Someone on the internet telling you. I think that's how most people find out, actually. The internet is rife with people telling other people that they are, in fact, gay. Anna and Vronsky are talking past each other. I think Anna understands Vronsky perfectly fine, but is unwilling to deal with the topic concretely. I don't know. That's actually all the conversation that we had today. Not much. Not a very inspiring chapter, I suppose, for the conversation part. Also, it's Christmas, so, you know. You're probably not going to be doing a whole lot of interneting during the Christmas days. So, all good. Let's just read chapter 33, shall we? Just move straight on. It's quite a long chapter too, so I'm keen to get stuck into it. Got to have an early morning tomorrow. Get to work by 7 a.m, so let's do this fast and furious. Chapter 33 goes like this. Vronsky, for the first time, felt vexed and almost angry with Anna for her unwillingness to realize her position. This feeling was strengthened by the fact that he could not tell her the reason of his vexation. Had he told her frankly what he thought, he could have said, "To appear dressed as you are at the theatre, accompanied by the princess whom everybody knows, means not only to acknowledge your position as a fallen woman, but to throw down a challenge to society, which means to renounce it forever." But he could not say this to her. But how can she fail to understand it, and what is happening to her? He asked himself. He felt that his regard for her had diminished, and his consciousness of her beauty increased simultaneously. He went down frowning to his rooms and taking a seat beside Yashvin, who sat with his long legs stretched out on a chair, drinking brandy and seltzer, ordered the same for himself, sorry. "You were talking about Lankovsky's powerful. He is a good horse, and I advise you to buy him," said Yashvin, glancing at his comrade's gloomy countenance. "It's true he has a goose rump, but his legs and head leave nothing to be desired." "I think I'll take him," replied Vronsky. This conversation about horses interested him, but he never forgot Anna and involuntarily listened to the steps in the corridor and glanced at the clock on the mantelpiece. "Anna Arkadyevna sent me to say that she has gone to the theatre," said a servant. Yashvin emptied another glass of brandy into the sparkling water, drank it, and then rose, buttoning his coat. "Well, let us go," he said, smiling slightly under cover of his big moustache, and showing by that smile that he understood the cause of Vronsky's depression, but did not attach importance to it. "I'm not going," said Vronsky dismally. "Well, I have got to, I promised." "Then au revoir." "But why not come to the stalls? Take Kraninsky's place," Yashvin added as he went out. "No, I have something to do. With a wife, one has trouble, but with one who is not a wife, it's worse," thought Yashvin as he left the hotel. Left alone, Vronsky got up and began pacing the room. What is on today? The fourth abonnement. Alexander will be there with his wife, and probably mother also. That's to say, all Petersburg will be there. Now she has gone in, taken off her cloak, and come forward into the light. Tushkevich, Yashvin, and Princess Barbara, he pictured them to himself. And what of me? Am I afraid, or have I put her under Tushkevich's protection? Whichever way one looks at it, it's a stupid position. Why does she put me in such a position? He said with a wave of his arm. As he made this gesture, he struck the little table on which the seltzer and a decanter of brandy were standing and almost knocked it over. In trying to save it from falling, he overturned it and in his vexation kicked it and rang the bell. "If you wish to remain in my service," he said to the valet when the latter came in, "remember your duties. There must be none of this sort of thing. You must clear it away." The valet, conscious that he was not to blame, was about to defend himself, but glancing at his master, saw by his face that there was nothing for it but to keep silent. So, stooping quickly, he knelt on the carpet and began sorting out the whole and broken glasses and bottles. "That's not your business. Send a waiter to clear it up. And get out of my dress suit." "Sweet. Suit? Suit." Vronsky entered the theatre at 8:30. The performance was in full swing. The attendant, an old man, helped him off with his overcoat, recognized him, and, addressing him as "Your Excellency," suggested that he need not take a ticket for his coat, but should merely call for Theodore when he wanted it. There was nobody in the brightly illuminated corridor except the attendant and two footmen, who, with their master's coats over their arms, stood listening out a door. Through a door slightly ajar came the sounds of a muffled staccato accompaniment by the orchestra and a female voice rending a musical phrase with precision. The door opened to let an attendant slip through, and the nearly completed phrase struck Vronsky's ears distinctly. The door was closed immediately, and he did not hear the end of the phrase nor the trill after it, but knew from the thunder of applause behind the door that the trill was finished. When he entered the auditorium, brilliantly illuminated by chandeliers and bronze gas brackets, the noise still continued. On the stage, the singer, in a glitter of bare shoulders and diamonds, was bowing low and smiling as she picked up, with the help of the tenor who held her hand, bouquets that had been clumsily flung across the footlights. She went up to the gentleman, with hair shiny with pomatum and parted in the middle, who was stretching his long arms across the footlights to hand her something, and the whole audience in the stalls and in the boxes stirred, leaned forward, shouted and applauded. The conductor from his raised seat helped to pass the bouquets and rearranged his white tie. Vronsky went to the middle of the floor, then stopped and looked around him. Today he paid less attention than ever to the familiar surroundings, the stage, the noise, and all that well-known, uninteresting, motley herd of audience in the packed theatre. In the boxes sat the same kind of ladies with the same kind of officers behind them as usual, the same kind of people, heaven only knew who, the same gaily dressed women, uniforms, frock coats, the same dirty crowd in the gallery, and in the whole of that throng in the boxes and front seats some 40 real men and women. To these oses Vronsky sat once, turned his attention, and immediately got into touch with them. The act had just finished when he came in, so before going to his brother's box, he went up to the front row and paused beside Serpukhovsky, who was standing with his knee bent. Tapping the wall of the orchestra with his heel. He had noticed Vronsky afar off and welcomed him with a smile. Vronsky had not yet seen Anna, who intentionally avoided looking her way, but from the direction in which people were looking, he knew where she was. He glanced around unobtrusively, but did not look at her. Prepared for the worst, he looked for Karenin. Luckily for him, Karenin was not in the theatre that evening. "How little of the military man is left in you," remarked Serpukhovsky. "You might be a diplomatist, an artist, or anything of that kind." "Yes, as soon as I returned home, I put on a black coat," Vronsky replied with a smile, slowly taking out his opera glasses. "Now in that I confess I envy you. I, when I come back from abroad and put this on again, regret my freedom," he said, touching his shoulder knot. Serpukhovsky had long ago ceased to trouble himself about Vronsky's career, but was as fond of him as ever, and was particularly amiable to him now. "A pity you were late for the first act." Vronsky, listening with one ear, levelled his glasses first at the lower tier and then at the boxes in the dress circle, taking them all in review. Next to a lady wearing a turban and a bald old man who blinked angrily just as Vronsky's moving glasses reached him, he suddenly saw Anna's proud head, strikingly beautiful and smiling in its frame of lace. She was in the fifth box in the lower tier, some 20 paces from him. She sat in the front of the box and, slightly turning back, was saying something to Yashvin. The poise of her head on her fine broad shoulders and the gleam of restrained excitement in her eyes and her whole face reminded him precisely of how he had seen her at the ball in Moscow. But her beauty affected him very differently now. There was no longer anything mysterious in his feelings for her, and therefore, though her beauty attracted him even more strongly, it also offended him. She was not looking his way, but he felt that she had already seen him. When Vronsky directed his glasses that way again, he noticed that the Princess Barbara was very red and that she was laughing unnaturally and looking round incessantly at the next box, while Anna, tapping with her closed fan the red velvet edge of the box, was gazing fixedly somewhere else, not seeing and evidently not wishing to see what was taking place in the next box. Yashvin's face wore the expression it had when he was losing at cards. He was frowning and drawing the left side of his moustache further and further into his mouth, looking askance at the adjoining box. In that box to the left were the Kartasovs. Vronsky knew them and knew that Anna had been acquainted with them. The wife, a thin little woman, was standing up in her box with her back to Anna, putting on an opera cloak which her husband was holding for her. Her face looked pale and angry, and she was speaking excitedly. Kartasov, a stout, bald-headed man, kept glancing round at Anna while trying to pacify his wife. When the wife left the box, the husband loitered behind, trying to catch Anna's eye, evidently wishing to bow to her. But Anna, with obvious intention, took no notice of him, and turning round, was saying something to Yashvin, whose cropped head was bent toward her. Kartasov went out without bowing, and the box remained empty. Vronsky could not make out what had taken place between the Kartasovs and Anna, but he saw that it was something humiliating for Anna. He realized that from what he had seen, and especially from Anna's face, who he knew was summoning her utmost strength to sustain the role she had undertaken, she fully succeeded in playing that role of external tranquility. Those who did not know her and her set, and heard none of her expressions of pity, indignation, and or surprise uttered by the woman because she had allowed herself to appear in public and to show herself so ostentatiously in her lace headdress and in all her beauty, admired the composure and loveliness of the woman, and did not suspect that she felt as though pilloried. Knowing that something had happened, but not knowing just what, Vronsky felt painfully agitated and hoping to find out something set out for his brother's box. Intentionally leaving the auditorium at the opposite side to where Anna was, he encountered the commander of his own old regiment, who stood talking to two acquaintances. Vronsky heard them mention the name Karenin and noticed how the commander hastened to call him loudly by name with a significant glance at the others. Vronsky, when are you coming to see us at the regiment? We can't let you go away without a feast. You are one of our very own, said the commander. I shall not have time, I am very sorry. Some other time, said Vronsky, and ran up the stairs to his brother's box. In the box was Vronsky's mother, the old countess, with her iron grey curls, Varya, and the Princess Sorokina he met in the corridor outside. Having conducted the Princess Sorokina back to Vronsky's mother, Varya held out her hand to her brother-in-law and at once began to talk of the matter that interested him. He had rarely seen her so excited. I consider it mean and disgusting, and Madame Kartasov had no right to do it. Madame Karenina, she began. But what is it? I don't know. Haven't you heard? You know I shall be the last to hear of it. Is there a creature more venomous than that Kartasova? But what has she done? My husband told me. She insulted Madame Karenina. Her husband began conversing with her from his box, and Kartasova flew at him. It seems she said something insulting out loud and then went out. Count, your maman wants you, said the Princess Sorokina, looking out of the box door. I have been expecting you all the time, said his mother, with a sarcastic smile. I never see anything of you. Her son saw that she could not repress a smile of satisfaction. Good morning, mamma. I was coming to you, he replied coldly. Why don't you go Felia la cour, Madame Karenin, pay court to Madame Karenin, she added. When the Princess Sorokina had stepped aside, elle fait sensation en oubli la petite pour elle. She is making a sensation. They are forgetting Patty because of her. Maman, I asked you not to speak to me about that subject, he answered, frowning. I am saying what everyone says. Vronsky did not reply, and after a few words addressed to the Princess Sorokina, he left the box. In the doorway, he met his brother. Ah, Alexis, said his brother. What a shame. That woman is a fool. That's all. I was just going to see her. Let's go together. Vronsky did not listen to him. He hurried downstairs, feeling that he must do something. He knew not what. He was disturbed both by vexation with Anna for placing herself and him in his false position, and by pity for her sufferings. He descended to the stalls and went straight to Anna's box, in front of which stood Stremov, talking to her. There are no more tenors. Le moule en est brise. Which means the mold for them is smashed. Vronsky bowed to her and stopped to shake hands with Stremov. I think you got here late and missed the finest aria, said Anna to him, with a mocking glance, as it seemed to him. I am a poor judge, he replied, looking severely at her. Like Prince Yashvin, who considers that Patty sings too loud, she returned with a smile. Thank you, she said, taking with her small gloved hand a program Vronsky had picked up for her. And suddenly, at that instant, her beautiful face quivered. She rose and went to the back of the box. Noticing that during the next act, her box remained empty, Vronsky left the theatre amid cries of hush from the audience, which had become quite quiet to listen to a cavatina. He went to his hotel. Anna had already returned when Vronsky entered. She was still dressed as she had been at the theatre. She was sitting in the first armchair by the wall, fixedly gazing before her. She glanced at him and immediately resumed her former posture. Anna, he said. It's all your fault, she exclaimed with tears of despair and spite in her voice and rose. But I asked, I entreated you not to go. I knew it would not be unpleasant for you. Unpleasant, she cried. It was awful. However long I may live, I shall never forget it. She said it was a disgrace to sit near me. The words of a silly woman, he said. But why risk it? Why provoke? I hate your calmness. You should not have driven me to it, if you loved me. Anna, is it a question of my love? Yes, if you loved me, as I love you, if you suffered the anguish I do, she replied with a frightened glance at him. He was sorry for her and yet vexed with her. He assured her of his love, because he saw that that alone could pacify her now, and did not reproach her with words, though he reproached her in his heart. And those assurances of love, which to him appeared so trivial that he felt ashamed to utter them, she drank in, and gradually became calm. Next day, fully reconciled, they left for the country. There you go, that's the end of part 5. Another part down, another chapter down. Have your say over at the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.